court is ready to hear argument in 041004, Hoover Slovacek, LLP versus John D. Walton.
Mr. Skip Watson will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. We wouldn't be here if this case had ended up settling for $10 million, as the attorneys who first prosecuted thought it would, precisely for that reason, that the allocation of risk, the Levine allocation of risk, that these parties undertook at the inception of the representation, after at least a half a dozen conferences, with multiple options on
the But assessing the value at the time the $6 million offer was on the table, right? I mean, that when he was terminated, you have to presume that that was a reasonable settlement that the client should have taken.
No, you do not, Your Honor.
So if it was an unreasonable settlement, you'd be entitled to your contingent fee based on an unreasonable settlement.
No. The only thing that matters here is that the two owners of the interest that was conveyed, what happened here was, the language is crystal clear. There was a conveyance of an undivided present interest in the claim, exactly what Justice Owen was talking about in Levine. In the subject matter of the contract, a conveyance of an undivided present interest. There were joint owners of the claim, just like Justice Brister was just talking about. The only thing that mattered was what those two owners of the claim agreed it was valued on when the client did not want the fired owner, the fired lawyer, to leave with an undivided interest in his claim. He was going to buy back the claim. Therefore, the two people to that agreement whose opinions counted were the lawyer who owned 30% undivided interest in the claim and the client who owned the 70%.
But how do you value that claim?
We just heard what the owners think. In this instance, we have the unique coming together of two or three days before the actual termination, a letter from the client saying, I will settle the claim for $6 million.
And you turn over to me, give me your interest in the property, which he didn't want to do.
No. I'm talking about the client's letter to the lawyer saying you have authority to settle my claim for $6 million without turning over anything.
And the claim was just over the amount of royalty underpayment. The claim did not involve the ranch and the easements and everything else.
Correct. That portion of the claim.
That portion of the claim. But
the lawyer agreed. The claim was worth $6 million.
But it seems like we're comparing apples and oranges here. I mean, if this claim is only for undervalued royalties, but the offer is X amount plus you give me the land, how do you equate those two?
Well, the claim is for much more than undervalued royalties. I think I see where you're going, Justice O'Neill. The lawyers identified four areas in the claim from the get-go. The royalty claim was one of those four. It had nine discrete elements in it. They ran out one of those elements in the audit that went through the 100 boxes for 2 weeks, ran it out 4 years, found that on one of the nine royalty claims, he was being undercharged $30,000 a month, or $1,087,000 over 4 years. He had an income stream of $42,000 a month. We know that. We know that at least half of his royalties were being underpaid. But we had surface damages. And this was the classic 30-year-old West Texas field where you had pipelines above ground that had to be buried. You had pipelines that ran off the lease lines on unleased land.
I guess what I'm saying, I'm not talking about differences in claims of that ilk. I'm talking about when someone offers to settle a claim, not by payment of money damages, but by payment of money damages plus give me your farm. Seems to me like you're presuming the rejection of that offer is unreasonable, therefore you value the $6 million settlement as something he should have taken.
I don't think so, Your Honor. The give me your land part of it was to avoid paying the surface damages. The contract allowed for such non-monetary benefits to the client by saying exactly like Levine talked about, saying if it's non-monetary, you give us 10% instead of 30%. We knew what was happening in that period was.
I guess what my point is, the offer was had a condition in it, or a piece of the offer was something that he would never have accepted. I mean, if that is the proof, that he never would have accepted getting rid of the farm, how can you say that that was an offer that should have been taken at the time it was made, and how can you base...
I'm not saying it should have been taken. I don't care what the offer on the table from the other side was. The other side was not a party to buying a claim and evaluating it between the two owners. One owner of 70% of the claim said, settle my claim for $6 million. The other owner, who was selling his claim back under this agreement, said, my 30% I also believe is worth $6 million. We have a person selling back saying $6 million. We have the owner buying back the 30% saying $6
million. But if the parties are looking at the same dollar figure, and one side's looking at that dollar figure with no conditions or contingencies, and the other side is looking at that dollar figure with conditions and contingencies, they're not really talking about the same number, are they?
It could be, Your Honor, and that's
assume they're important contingencies. They're not looking at the same number.
No question. But that's the reason that, I mean, the talk of this jury verdict being based in part on the $6 million offer with contingencies doesn't fly, because the jury rejected both the 70% owner's evaluation and the 30% owner's evaluation. And they could have gotten there two ways. They didn't come in at six. They came in at $3.1 million. And there are two ways in the record they could have gotten there. The first is the expert testified from his audit that he did that the damages that he saw that he knew he could talk about were between $2 and $4 million. Second, we know that on the $6 million offer, the one you're talking about, Justice O'Neill.
The offer by
Bass. Not by the client.
Because they're different. They both have the same number.
I understand. I'll try to be clear. The Bass offer saying rather than clean up, we want to buy the surface so we can continue to trash it. That offer. If the Bass offer were there and was $6 million, we know that previously Walton had given written authority for an $8.5 million offer. We have the attorney's notes on that.
Without giving up property.
Yes, with giving up property. 8.5, and I will give up my royalty interest.
I'm talking about surface estate.
Okay, let me just finish, if I may. We know that he valued his royalty interest, which is what were ultimately given up. We know he valued those at 2.5 to 3 million. Taking that 2.5 to 3 million off of even his $6 million evaluation, let alone the other side six, also gets you to the $3.14 million given by the jury. The value of the surface is a non-issue as proven by the settlement eventually reached. Of course they wanted to buy the surface. That's the clean way to do it. The land is already devalued by the prior 30 years of operations. That's the cheap way. The easy way, and the way that Parrott told Walton in the record that it would work out, is what they really want is right-of-way easements. They've got to have right-of-way easements where they don't have your existing fee ownership or present easements. That's exactly what they did.
Measuring value, though, value is a function not necessarily of what the client values it at, but what a willing payer or buyer would pay for it.
In this instance, that's the client. He is the willing buyer.
But you're not challenging the jury's finding of $900,000, are you?
We're desperately trying to hang on to it.
Okay, so you're taking that, and that's your client said, in his opinion, it was $1.7 million or something, as I understand. His value. You're satisfied with the jury's finding.
Absolutely.
Okay, so the value that the jury, we're talking about, Justice O'Neill just questioned, we're not arguing about how they got there. You're satisfied with it. The question is, what does the term value mean in the contract here? Is that an appropriate way to measure it? I thought that's what we're here about, not the $900,000 or how they got there.
Well, that's what I thought too, Your Honor. The point that I'm trying to make is you determine the value by one, obviously, what the buyer and the seller of this interest in the claim, being the lawyer and the client, but the value they put on it. Two, by the expert coming in and saying, I value the claim between $2 and $4 million.
Okay, so in this contract then, the term value does not depend on a subjective thought process by the client or the lawyer. It's an objective measure of some nature. Is that your position? When it says you'll pay then present value of the contingent fee, is your position at the time they reached that agreement, that was intended to be an objective something that you decide apart from the client? And
Your Honor, I'm saying it obviously works on common sense. It contemplates the two getting together and seeing if they can arrive at
value. But they didn't. That's why we're here.
They did. Correct.
So how, at the time they wrote the agreement then, did it contemplate someone is going to have to decide value?
That's right, and that's why it came down to experts cross-testifying as to what the value of the claims were.
Why is that not unconscionable when you get all this money here at the back end?
Well, that's a very
because
good question.
I mean, in hindsight, we can look at it, and all he's lost his money.
That's the point. To get there, to do what you just talked about, you have to turn the law of unconscionability upside down, and that's what was done here. You can best see it by looking at the UCC formulation of unconscionability, and in comment one, it's very telling. Both the UCC, the restatement, and the disciplinary rules say you judge the conscionability or unconscionability of a contract at the moment of its making, not in hindsight, precisely
to
avoid these problems.
Do you think there is an unevenness of ability to anticipate the value of claim, risk involved, as between the lawyer and the client, even if the client is sophisticated, that makes it necessary to, if not look at unconscionability in hindsight, at least take a peek or something? It seems to me the lawyer going in has a better idea of what is going to happen than the client. Maybe that's not true.
I don't think it is true. I think that the client is in an infinitely better position to know the facts, to know exactly what's out there, what the basis of his or her claim is. But you're getting to the heart of it right here. Unconscionability deals with this. And the fundamental tenet of unconscionability that runs through all three areas of law, and let me just read to you from UCC 2.302. There we find in comment one, they say, rather than do it the old way of manipulating public policy because we don't like the result, instead, we're going to look at it exclusively prospectively, and the object is, quote, not of disturbance of allocation of risk because of superior bargaining power. That is not what unconscionability was created for, precisely what you were saying. Going on to restatement number of contracts, 208, unconscionability, quote, a bargain is not unconscionable merely because the parties to it are unequal in bargaining position. nor even because the inequality results in an allocation of risk to the weaker party. That is the basic tenet that underlines the law of unconscionability until this case. That was carried forward in our DRs. May I finish the sentence, Your Honor?
Yes.
Comment 8 of DR 104 has this example. A fee agreement negotiated at arm's length with an experienced business client would rarely be subject to question. Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Daniel Sheehan will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. The question of value in this case is really ancillary. The court has asked questions, how do you value the claim? I believe Mr. Watson has identified the wrong parties in doing that. And I'm going to talk a minute about how you value the claim. But more importantly, the value issue in this case is really just an illustration of what's wrong with this type of fee provision. It sets an unworkable standard that subjects the client to whatever the lawyer decides, that lawyer who's probably bitter or unhappy because of termination, says the case is worth.
No, it doesn't. That was just what one lawyer said, but the provision doesn't say that. The provision just says present value. It doesn't say present value that you think.
Well, that's correct. I agree with that, but there's no standard in the contract for how that's determined. And Mr. Parrott testified at trial that his interpretation of that provision, which he wrote, is that he would decide what the present value of the sub.
Well, but surely there are agreements all the time where a breach involves a damages question of value that is not specified how it's going to be determined in the contract.
We're talking here, Justice Hecht, about a lawyer-client fee agreement. We're talking about the principles in Levine, where this court has said our holding is not novel. It is simply emphasizes one facet of the lawyer's duty to a client, to inform a client of the basis or rate of the fee at the outset of the matter.
Well, I understand that, but the Court of Appeals said, well, this lawyer said value is what we believed it to be. Well, he did say that, but that's not what the contract says. So it looks like to me the easy answer to that is you're just not right.
Well,
and the Court of Appeals says, and you didn't specify how value is going to be determined. But surely there are thousands of contracts that don't specify how value is going to be determined. That doesn't keep you from determining value by the income approach, appraisal approach, some application of value principles.
Well, I agree, Your Honor, and it certainly is easy for the client to say that that is not the value, Mr. Parrott. The value is something else. The problem is the ultimate decision maker is going to be a court. And what you have, when you have that kind of disagreement, is you have guaranteed that the client is going to be subjected to lengthy and expensive litigation simply because that client does not agree with the lawyer's assessment of what he's owed.
But it's a common problem that clients think the case may be worth a lot more than the lawyer thinks it's worth. You wouldn't argue that this provision is. Are you arguing that this provision is unconscionable on its face?
Yes,
no,
sir.
No attorney, no client can ever do this.
I think the provision is unconscionable on its face.
And so, the fact that clients often have an exaggerated value because all they read is the newspapers and watch TV of what their claim is worth. Attorney tells them, look, let's settle for what they're offering now. This is the best you're ever going to get. The client says no, and not only that, because you're not fighting hard enough for me, I'm firing you. Claim is run into the ground. You recover 10 cents on what the client thought was a dollar. And there's just simply nothing the fired lawyer can do about that. But it turns out the fired lawyer was right. Well, they should have taken it. And the fired lawyer would have gotten what the grown-ups agreed to in the contract. You're saying, forget about it. It's all unconscionable.
Well, but the client...
Clients can run their lawyer's assigned fee into the ground with impunity.
I wouldn't characterize it that way, Justice Brister. What I would say is the client has the sole prerogative regarding settlement. And if the client thinks a case is worth $10 million and the lawyer thinks it's worth $50,000, that's just too bad for the lawyer. He has to live with that, because if the client needs a $10 million offer to take to settle the case, then he's absolutely entitled to refuse anything less.
Mr. Sheehan, this looks like it's an attempt by the lawyer to, at termination by the client, fix the obligations so they can separate themselves. That's what it looks like. But how can a contingency fee be determined by a law if a lawyer wanted to terminate on a contingency fee claim, other than just saying, I'm going to hang on to my contingency fee and whatever you get at the end, I'll take? Is there no other option for a lawyer to do to terminate and separate from that client in a contingency fee arrangement?
I think there are other options.
For example, what would one be?
Well, for example, the lawyer could write in the contract that in the event of termination, I'm entitled to be paid for the hours I've devoted times $250.
But what if that turns out to be $150,000 and the client recovers $50,000 at the back end? Aren't we in the same situation we are here, where we're hindsighting to see whether it's a good or bad deal after all of that's over?
No, I don't think so, and I think here's the difference. The client knows going in what he's got to pay if he does terminate. And when he terminates, he can exercise that prerogative, which is also entirely the client's, knowing that this is going to cost me $50,000 or $150,000 or whatever it is that the lawyer's time adds up to. The client makes a knowing decision and takes the risk of taking the case forward. Now, the lawyer is protected from the lawyer is fully compensated, and if the client gets another lawyer who may not be nearly as capable and, in fact, damages the client's claim and the client recovers less, that's all risk that belongs to the client. But the client has a contract that tells him what's going to happen to him when he terminates.
So that's all attorneys have to have it that way? You can't have a provision where you keep a contingent share once you're fired? It has to be hourly?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor. I'm just saying you can write a termination provision that's fair to the client and definite and ascertainable at the time it's done.
If it had come out the other way and the recovery is actually 10 times it was what at the time the Hoover Slovacek firm was fired, the client says, why in the world should they get 30% of work that Andrews Kurth did? They were letting this case run into the ground. Andrews Kurth saved it. I don't want to pay them 30%. Your theory would be, since it's unconscionable, can't do that either.
Well, I think it's time for the court to revisit the Mandel and Wright versus Thomas rule.
That's what you're asking us to do.
Well, I'm not asking that, because I don't think that rule is directly.
Mandel says if you're fired without cause, you get exactly what your contract says.
That's right. And Mandel, his analysis consists of exactly one paragraph. That determination has never been revisited, and that determination, as I understand it, it stands alone in the jurisprudence in the United States. No other state follows that rule.
But you say not to revisit it.
I say you don't need to. I actually think you should revisit it, and this is probably a good case to do it in. I say you don't need to do it because Mandel and Wright does not authorize a lawyer to charge an unconscionable fee. And so, and this is an unconscionable fee.
How do you determine that? Post-judgment? I mean, how do you go? The fee may be extremely reasonable at the time, or appear to be reasonable at the time the contract is made. And facts may be here, maybe situation that we had earlier where you party recovers $10,000 if there's an agreement to pay the lawyers $100,000.
I think you can determine it at the time it was made, for sure. In this instance, for unconscionability, we don't need the UCC and restatement of contracts. All we need to do is go to Rule 104, where it's defined. It's unconscionable if a competent lawyer cannot form a reasonable belief that the fee is reasonable. Now, if the fee basis that Mr. Walton entered into with the Hoover Bax firm had been explained to him, if you sit down with a competent lawyer and say, Mr. Lawyer, do you think that a fee agreement that allows a lawyer who's been terminated to set the price on his fee and collected immediately without regard to outcome and without regard to whether the termination was with cause or without cause, do you think that's a reasonable fee?
But on the other hand, this is presented to a jury, right? I mean, jury read the agreement itself and maybe it determined, you know, we disregard his testimony on valuation. We think we know what the value is, and we decide it's not unconscionable. Well, so you're saying that any time this language is presented, it is conclusively unconscionable, and I have some trouble with that.
I think it's unconscionable when the language allows the lawyer to decide what the fee is going to be and tell the client. And one of the reasons that I think it's unconscionable.
But why didn't the jury decide that? The jury question didn't ask them what does Hoover Slovacek think the value was. They says what was the value.
I understand.
So if they say this is the value and they say it wasn't unconscionable, what basis does the judge come in and say, well, they're just all wrong?
The jury's wrong?
Yeah.
Well, because...
Because we have a higher moral sensitivity than jurors do.
Well, I think that's right, and I think because the jury in this case... Well, let me just put it this way. This fee is so outrageous that this court should hold it's unconscionable as a matter of law, as the Court of Appeals did. And the Hoover firm takes issue with the analysis by which the Court of Appeals got to that result. But this brings us back to the value questions that Justice O'Neill was asking about at the outset of the argument. The value is not, Mr. Watson says this is fair because Mr. Walton and the Hoover firm both said $6 million is a good settlement and therefore that sets the value. Those parties' opinions are meaningless. The only opinion that matters in terms of what the value of the case is the defendant's. How much is the defendant going to be willing to pay? And the evidence on that is that 18 months after the Hoover firm was terminated, they offered finally.
Well, that's not the only evidence. The evidence is also an offer that included these other conditions about unloading the ranch, and the jury could sort that out, couldn't they?
I don't believe the jury could sort that out.
Why not?
Because there's no evidence of what the surface estate is worth. There's no evidence of what the separately standing royalty interests are worth. There's no evidence of what the various rights away and option and easements are worth. By the time you add all those things up, I suspect that the value of the claims was zero.
Where the lawyer
is not entitled to a contingent fee.
Remind me where the ranch was.
It's in Winkler County.
And where?
Winkler.
Close to what big
city? Close to, I guess, Odessa.
Now, I've driven through Odessa. I could make a guess of how much a ranch out in that area of the state, I won't say desert wasteland because we're on the record, in that lovely area of the state, I could make a guess as how much a value. Why couldn't a jury make the same guess, especially if they live out there?
Well, since when have we allowed
But you're not here. You're not here on a note. There was no evidence of the value of the ranch. I mean, you know, what? Why couldn't the jury take that into account and say, okay, yeah, $6 million plus turning over part of this empty sector of Texas is worth less than $6 million without that condition, but not 98% less. Why couldn't a jury do all of that stuff? Why haven't they done that stuff? And how do we just tell them, no, you're wrong?
Well, we don't let juries do things like that. The court just heard argument in the last case about how important expert testimony is in value. We're going to let a jury just guess at how much Mr. Walton's property that the Basses were offering to buy is worth. The attorney is not entitled to a percentage of the client's property that he already owns and that nobody is trying to take away from him. This was not an offer to settle claims. It was an offer to buy real estate and oil and gas interests.
Mr. Sheehan? Was there no evidence at trial that anyone, that any lawyer, believed this would be a reasonable fee? Now, we have Mr. Parrott. Did he testify that he thought it was a reasonable agreement?
Mr. Parrott did. They're experts.
Was it proved that he was not a competent lawyer?
I think he's an interested lawyer.
A jury could disbelieve that. But that was some evidence of a competent lawyer, that a competent lawyer could believe this was a reasonable fee.
Mr. Parrott is the only testimony on their side of this case that the fee was reasonable. They put a retired district judge or former district judge from Houston, Richard Bianchi, on the stand, and even he didn't testify that it was not unconscionable. His answer
The contract or the fee? There's a difference. The agreement or the end result?
The fee.
The fee. How about the agreement, the way that you would calculate the termination fee?
I don't believe he was asked if he thought that the methodology or the method set forth in the contract was reasonable. The question really is...
Mr. Sheehan, I'm not clear. You think that in determining the contingency fee in this contract, looking at value, the only indication of the value is the defendant's settlement offer?
That's the only... No, there's indications of the value. And yes, there's various pieces of evidence regarding the defendant's settlement offer. And the case has no value, is my point, except for what the defendant is willing to pay, and that's if Mr. Walton is willing to accept it. Those are the two things you need to decide value.
So you do need more than the defendant.
Yes.
You need the client and the defendant. But the lawyer's valuation, you think, is immaterial?
I don't think, yes.
You disagreed with what Mr. Watson said about that.
I think the lawyer's valuation of a case is absolutely immaterial. The defendant is the one that's going to decide what he will pay, and the client is going to decide whether he accepts it. A lawyer can be as trained and skilled and experienced as possible and have an opinion. Well, I've been doing this for 50 years, and I think this case is worth X. And it really doesn't matter, because it's only worth that if the client's going to take it.
Okay, so when can you set the present value of the contingency fee?
I don't think you can.
Only after the settlement has occurred?
I don't think a lawyer on a contingent fee under the Levine case says. A lawyer on a contingent fee is entitled to the fee only when and to the extent the client receives a recovery. Now, this contract says something else. That's what Levine says, and in saying it, it followed Restatement of Law Governing Lawyers, Section 35, and adopted that provision.
So it sounds like you're agreeing with what Justice Johnson said a few minutes ago. You take this percentage, contingency percentage in the contract, look at what settlement actually occurred, and the lawyer's entitled to that percentage, because that is the value, actually, of the settlement.
That's only if the court believes that Mandel and Rice is good law. Because what the restatement says about this is that the lawyer is entitled to a pro rata share of the settlement, of the fee. So if it's a one-third fee and the lawyer worked the case halfway through before he was terminated, that lawyer is entitled to one-half of that one-third fee. That way the client doesn't end up paying two fees. I think it's important to remember that the client's right to terminate a lawyer is absolute. It's unqualified. And we have cases out there that talk about the client breaching the fee contract because he terminated the lawyer. And we've got the Mandel case out here talking about whether this termination was with cause or not. All the while, we have Rule 1.15 of the disciplinary rules that says the lawyer's right to terminate a client is its absolute right, with or without cause. So my question is, if that's in fact the client...
But you may still have to pay damages as well.
Well, yes, of course you do.
My understanding is that's what the rule of all contracts is.
You certainly have to pay compensation.
You can always breach the contract by canceling it. You can always fire the football coach, but you may have to pay his salary.
You can... This isn't a football coach. This is a lawyer.
I know, but that's all contracts are that way. You can always stop the contract as long as you pay damages.
I certainly agree with that. And there's discussion in the brief where the Hoover firm talks about when a client discharges an attorney without cause, the client not only breaks the contract and then goes on. That's not so. In fact, the contract itself says he has a right to terminate. The disciplinary rule says it is. The only question is, if that event happens, how much does a lawyer going to get?
Well, let me ask you this. What if the contract had said, if you terminate our representation, you have to immediately pay $500,000. You agree to pay $500,000. Would our disciplinary rules allow for that?
It will not allow for it if no reasonable lawyer could form a competent lawyer could form a reasonable belief that that's a reasonable fee. That's the standard that's judged by. That example at least gives the client some certainty, but it doesn't mean it's not an unconscionable fee.
So whether it's unconscionable depends upon what? How much work's been done at that point? Or
It depends on whether a reasonable lawyer, a competent lawyer, could form a reasonable belief that it's a reasonable fee. And that can have an infinite number of factors that goes into that.
Mr.
The strength
Shen,
of the case, the size of the amount of controversy.
Would you agree with this statement? Court should enforce the fee arrangement between the client and the attorney that's written, so long as it complies with ethical obligations of lawyers.
Yes.
And if it doesn't comply, then can enforce at least the parts that don't comply.
I think
the question I guess you're presenting is to what extent this contract should be changed by the ethical overlay.
There's three rules from the ethics that overlay this fee contract and all fee contracts, and there's probably others, but these three are in play in this case. 1.04, which is the rule about you can't charge an unconscionable fee, contrary to what they say, which is that this court in Mandel established a bright line that the attorney gets his full fee regardless of the financial burden. That's not correct. The other one that is implicated is 1.15, which the client has an absolute right to terminate. That right belongs to the client, and that has to be kept in mind when you assess how much the client's going to have to pay to exercise a right that he has in his absolute. And finally, 1.02, that settlement is in the sole discretion of the client, and that has bearing on this issue of value and means to me that Mr. Parrott cannot simply come in and announce to Mr. Walton what the value is. And clients should not be put in the position, if they disagree with that, to have to go through long, drawn-out, expensive litigation in order to get a real value.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Watson, let's say I'm injured, personal injury case. I'm permanently disabled. My damages are in the millions of dollars. I hire you on a contingent fee basis, and the same provisions in the contract. And I decide that you're not representing me well, so I want to terminate your representation. And you say, well, you've got an $8 million claim. Pay me $2.5 million right now. Well, the reason I hired you on a contingent fee basis is I can't afford to pay you cash for the case. Unconscionable?
Yes.
Okay. Now, so you say it is relative to the ability of the parties to pay.
It's always judged up front by looking at the contract, the relationship with the parties, the total situation. For example, in 104, I mean, it speaks to that, to exactly what you're talking about. And it says two factors in otherwise borderline cases, which is what you're talking about, might indicate a fee may be unconscionable. This is comment 8. The first, overreaching by the lawyer, particularly of a client who was unusually susceptible to overreaching. This is why you need to wait for another Mandel and Wright to deal with Mandel and Wright and this issue. Another Mrs. Thomas sitting there crying with the union steward saying, here's your lawyer and he has something for you to sign. That's first, an unusually susceptible client. Second, a failure of the lawyer to give at the outset, and this includes in the contract or verbally, an accurate explanation of how the fee was to be calculated. Those are the two factors that determine. And then it goes on to say, in our situation, but a fee agreement negotiated at arm's length with an experienced business client would rarely be subject to question. I mean, the rule deals with your situation. You look at it up front. If there's, here we have a man able to pay $300,000 in attorney's fees hourly. He did it. He wanted to try it on a contingency basis. He had the ability. He had the wherewithal and the business acumen. He had $42,000 a month coming in runs. He wants to be able to have this clause in so he could get the assignment of his claim back, to fix it and to get it back and not be in a Mandel and Wright situation.
If the rule stated in Mandel and Wright is wrong, how does that impact your position?
If Mandel is right, if that is wrong, it impacts us primarily on our second level, where the court went so far as to create a brand new public policy saying that anything that impinges on a client's right to change counsel, including hourly fees, including flat fees or retainers, could be held to be unconscionable. That's where it comes in. Did they go too far in doing that, and is there a lesser way of doing it? The reason the court had to do that, Your Honor, was not at this level. It was to keep us from even getting our 28.66% of the $900,000 settlement at the end.
I assume your position is, even if the rule stated Mandel and Wright is incorrect, you still prevail.
Correct.
It's just not automatic.
Correct. Absolutely.
Mr. Watson, was there evidence about how much time the Hoover back lawyers had spent? How much time? How many hours?
I don't think it was in there, Your Honor. What was in there, to just very quickly recap, Justice Johnson nailed it, that the obligation is not what the lawyer said it was going to be. The value was not what he said it was going to be. There was testimony not just from the lawyer but also from the judge that this was reasonable, the judge said proper, under the disciplinary rule standards. The evidence was there to uphold the verdict.
Thank you. The cause is submitted, and that concludes all arguments this morning. The marshal will now adjourn the court.
All right. Okay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.